From the garden to your radio, this is a Perpetual Notion machine for Thursday, April 13th, 2017. I'm your host, Will Cushman. The season's earliest flowering plants have already been in bloom for a week or so in Madison, and that means it is pollinator season. So tonight we're focusing on one pollinator in particular. It's called the rusty-patched bumblebee. It was the first bumblebee actually to be granted protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act, which it received pretty recently. It's become increasingly rare in the last 15 years for a number of reasons, which we'll discuss tonight. I know this topic has the potential to be a little depressing, but please stick with us because we're also discussing tonight how you, local Madisonians, can support the rusty-patched bumblebee and its pollinator brethren. Also, as if Madison needed another reason to be great, it's one of the few places where the rusty-patched bumblebee is still found. So that's pretty cool. It's found at our very own UW-Madison Arboretum. Tonight's guest joins us from the Arboretum. Susan Carpenter is the Senior Outreach Specialist for UW-Madison Arboretum. She's an expert on native plant gardening, sustainable gardening practices, bumblebee conservation, citizen-based monitoring, and southern Wisconsin bumblebees, including the rusty-patched bumblebee. Susan has led the successful establishment of a four-acre Wisconsin native plants garden at the Arboretum in Madison, which supports native pollinators, including the rusty-patched bumblebee. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Starting off, could you describe a little bit more to our listeners what exactly it is that you do at the Arboretum? I'm sure a lot of them are familiar with the Arboretum, but yeah, if you could describe what you do and how the rusty-patched bumblebee fits into your work.
Sure. Well, we have a native plant garden around the visitor center, and it's been there for we started it about 14, 15 years ago. So it's been a work in progress. It represents the native plant communities of southern Wisconsin. So we have prairie gardens, savanna gardens, woodland gardens, and some rain gardens. So the idea is to provide a demonstration garden. I work with students and community volunteers to take care of the garden. So we have about 70 volunteers out every season. We're starting up next week with our gardening sessions. So how we got involved with the rusty patch bumblebee was that about 6 years ago, a bee expert visited the garden. I didn't meet him at the time. He was just coming through, and he was photographing bumblebees, and he found this very rare bumblebee, the rusty patch bumblebee. Sent the photo to us when he returned home and had confirmed the ID, and he was surprised that it was there because the rusty patch has been lost over most of its geographic range. He asked us, have you seen more of these? This is a very rare bee. And we honestly had to say, we don't know, because we hadn't been paying any much attention to the different kinds of bumblebees.
Sure.
So we started our project, and we have a photography project where volunteers are taking photographs, and us and our staff, student staff, are taking pictures. And with bumblebees, you can identify the bees fairly reliably from photographs, which is not usually the case for all the other wide variety of native bees that are present. So that allowed us to find out that we have about 12 species of bumblebees at the Arboretum, and including the rusty patch, which has still been a consistent, been there consistently in small numbers over these years.
What about the rusty patch bumblebee identifying?
Oh, the characteristic that you could notice?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, because there are a number of bees that have brownish, reddish, or rusty patches on their color patterns. The way that you recognize the rusty patch is that the females, the female workers, and the males, which are the main bees that you would see out and about during the season, have on their abdomen, they have one yellow stripe toward the front end of the bee, and then another yellow stripe. And embedded in that second yellow stripe toward the front is a little rusty patch. So when you look at the bee, that's the distinctive pattern, and it's pretty consistent for that bee. The queens do not have a rusty patch. So I've just heard yesterday that a couple of the rusty patch queens have been spotted already in Madison. They're out and about. So they don't have a rusty patch. So that gets a little trickier in identification.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you said that the rusty patch bumblebee is very rare nowadays. I'm wondering, why exactly that is. So where does the rusty patch bumblebee fit into the like native ecosystems and the native pollinator community, and is it, why does it seem to be so much rarer or more affected by habitat loss, I'm assuming?
There are several factors. And just to step back for a minute, as far as where it fits in the ecosystem, we have in Wisconsin altogether, there are about 25 species of bumblebees. So those are the big familiar bees that people are, you know, people would recognize probably, many different kinds. And within some of the species, there's a lot of different color variations. So it seems even more variable just as you start to observe them than 25 species, but there they are. We have in all 500 native bee species in Wisconsin alone.
Wow.
So those are ranging from little tiny bees that you probably you might not even recognize as a bee, on up to the biggest bumblebees. So where they all fit into the ecosystem is they are all important in their own way in pollinating native plants and in some cases pollinating crop plants. So bumblebees are very good at pollinating a lot of our vegetable crops, a lot of our economically important crops and fruits here in Wisconsin. So they are wild bees. They're out there flying around pollinating. There's no hives. There's no maintenance for example, that we have with the non-native honeybees. So they're basically providing a pollination service out and about for free. And the reason pollination is important, besides the obvious thing for getting tomatoes, peppers, and other other good, delicious things like that, is that the plants themselves and the reproduction of plants, so the production of seeds and so forth, is the basis of the food web of everything else.
Okay.
That's one reason why they're important. You asked about why are they rare or what are some of the factors in this really dramatic reduction in the rusty patch bumblebee's population. So it used to be all over the East Coast, into our area and even a little further west up into Minnesota, down into the southeast, say Tennessee, Georgia area. And it used to be quite a common bee, commonly seen. But then about 15 years ago or so, and I'm hedging a little on that because, you know, there's not exact population numbers for any of our wild bees or a lot of other things for that matter throughout our ecosystems. But we do know that the populations declined pretty dramatically through that period. And now our about 90% of the range is not found in about 90% of its range anymore. So the factors that are really involved with that, as we understand them, you can think of a circle divided into four parts, and one part of that would be habitat loss and fragmentation. So as, say, an area becomes heavily agriculture or heavily urbanized, there'll be less and less habitat available.
What is their native habitat?
Well, their native habitat is interesting because they need flowering resources for their food source from now, at least in our area here in Wisconsin, from the time that the queens emerge in the spring and then start to build the colony. They need pollen and they need nectar because the pollen is used to feed the young and the nectar is the carbohydrate source for the adults.
Sure.
So they have to be gathering both of those now, the queen is starting the colony and getting the worker bees, getting a group of worker bees raised, then they'll begin to forage and bring resources back to the nest while the queen continues to lay eggs. The colony isn't very large, maybe the size of a softball, and or that amount of volume. And so that's a few hundred bees for each colony. And each colony has to be started each spring from the start, from zero,
right,
or from this queen. So the queens are produced late in the season, and then they overwinter under soil. So what is their habitat? They need flowering resource from the spring, like now, all the way through until possibly, for most of them, probably into September.
Okay.
And late in the season is when the new queens for next year are produced. So that when they're hatched and they are out foraging for a little bit, but mostly mating and then going into their their dormant state, and they dig in under soil and spend the winter like that.
Okay.
And all those other bees from the current year's colony would die, and just that queen is carrying through the winter.
Gotcha.
So the next part of the circle of that I'm using to mentally represent the reasons for the decline, or the reasons that we think there's a decline, the next section would be diseases and pathogens. So there are diseases that that the bees can be exposed to. There are some that diseases that the source of which is some bumblebees have been cultivated or they're used commercially.
Oh, sure.
So these are commercial bees, kind of domesticated bees, bumblebees, and they're used in the greenhouse trade. So we have a greenhouse full of tomatoes. That's where we get our winter tomatoes. A greenhouse full of tomatoes, and the bumblebees are a box of bumblebee are brought in there, a colony, and they pollinate the tomatoes, and then some of them may go out and escape. So when you have animals in tight quarters, and when you have animals in where they're really being kind of crowded together and so forth, there's more chance of disease. And so it's thought that some of the disease from that kind of situation could have been transmitted to the wild populations. Pathogens, I mean, there are other stressors that could be present in wild bees. And so another section of that circle would be insecticides and pesticides. So mainly insecticides. And now, of course, we have the systemic insecticides. And by systemic, I mean that if that insecticide is applied to a plant or to the soil around the plant, in some cases, the plant takes that up and the insecticide is throughout the plant.
Okay.
And it remains throughout the plant. So any insect that is trying to eat that plant, of course, would not make it.
Right.
But if we think about the pollen and the nectar that is being produced by that plant, there can be an effect of that on pollinators, which is kind of an unintended consequence, but nevertheless something to be concerned about. So these chemicals are used, and their use has increased over this period in agriculture and commercial agriculture, both in seed treatments and in soil drenches. And so people need to be aware, if they're buying bedding plants or plants for their garden, that they need to make sure that those plants they haven't been treated. So it's good to ask the store,
right,
have these plants been treated? Because it won't be obvious by looking at the plant whether or not it's been pre-treated with insecticides.
Are they ever labeled that way, or is it something that you should check with the employees?
Yeah, I think you should check, because this is just a growing area of kind of consumer awareness as well. In my understanding, they may be labeled. There are some places that will tell you that they're not using them. So in that sense, it might be labeled, because it is a point of, I know some of the native plant nurseries will have it right. They'll just have it a blanket statement. None of our material is treated. And,
right.
And so that's good to know. But yeah, otherwise you'd want to check, because there's no requirement that they label that they are treated. And now we need the fourth.
Right. So we did habitat loss and fragmentation, pathogens,
and
then and diseases,
and then insecticides, yeah,
right,
and pesticides. And the fourth one is changing climate and extreme weather events.
Right.
So bumblebees are a cool weather animal. They can exist here fine in the summers, but as far as their range goes, they are more diverse in northern latitudes than in southern latitudes, which is kind of the opposite pattern from a lot of biodiversity. And a study recently showed that if you think about the geographic range of a bumblebee from north to south, as temperatures increase, and this is, of course, getting warmer to the southern edge of the range,
mm-hmm,
the bumblebee's range is being contracted, and it's not really expanding to the north. I talked a little bit about the life cycle, and there's not a lot of long-distance migration anywhere in that life cycle, if you stop to think about it, or at least that's the way I think about it.
Right.
So if a range contraction is going on, it might end up being so, so narrow that the bees can't, don't really have much of a range left.
Right.
And we are seeing a lot of, we're seeing a lot of changes to timing of, emergence and timing of plant resources and so forth, just in general with climate change.
So you've talked about all these reasons for the decline in the rusty-patched bumblebee, but the rusty-patched bumblebee is just one of really many pollinators that have been in decline lately. So are these factors that are affecting the pollinator community at large? Are there some pollinators, like the rusty patch bumblebee, that may be for some reason more affected by some of these factors than other? Are there some pollinators that are more resistant or resilient?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. Within bumblebees, there are some that don't seem to be showing any declines, and that makes it kind of mysterious, yeah, because you'd think, well, maybe they're all similar. This brings up a really good point, and that is that there are a lot of knowledge gaps. So if we think about this kind of from the science end, mm-hmm, you think of 500, I bet you were surprised to hear there's 500 species of native bees in Wisconsin.
Totally.
We there are many of those that we don't know very much about. Luckily, with bumblebees, we do know a little bit more because they're bigger and they're important agriculturally, and people have been looking at them. There are programs, for example, the Xerces Society has a program called Bumblebee Watch, which is an online platform for if you have a picture of a bumblebee, say you go outside here, outside the studio, find a bumblebee, take a picture of it, you can upload it to that site. And they will, there's a place for you to map where you saw it and tell a little bit of information. And then you can take a stab at identification with the tools they have there. And then they will verify your identification on there. And then it adds to the map, and you can look, you know, you could look in on different species, you could look at different areas, different years, and so forth. And so that's just been in place a few years. It's building up with data, and a lot of those data were very important for this recent listing of Rusty Patch, because you know those were actual locations where it's been verified, you know, that it's living still.
Cool. And so that's the Xerces Society, and that's with an X, right?
Yeah, Xerces.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But bumblebeewatch.org is easy to remember.
Right.
And that's the site, and it's right there, and it's a really great site. It's fun to just look and see, to zero in and see where different bees have been seen. So getting back to the different species of bumblebees, we do have other species of bumblebees within the state that are quite rare.
Okay.
And so there are two in particular, the American bumblebee and the yellow-banded bumblebee in Wisconsin, that are quite rare. And so they have state designation, species of greatest conservation need, just like the rusty patch does. And then there's the next level of concern, kind of below that level. The yellow bumblebee is in that category. So it's a species of greatest conservation need, just slightly less serious than those. So these are bees that you might encounter, and if photographs, adequate photographs can document them,
mm-hmm,
and then putting those on Bumblebee Watch, it just adds to what we do know. There are a lot of things we don't know,
right?
And I mean, this example from the Arboretum is a good example, a good kind of story I like to impress on people, because we just started from basically that photograph and began to learn more and more, and that turns out to be a pattern that's true of a lot of different questions, observations, phenomena that anybody can make in their backyard or nearby area where they're, you know, where they are outdoors, and just paying attention. So I would recommend to your listener to go for it and dig into questions that they're interested in. It might be something that no one really knows anything about.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So getting to the kind of the conservation designations that you hit on, mm-hmm, correct me if I'm wrong, but the rusty patch bumblebee, it's the first bumblebee to receive protection under the Endangered Species Act?
That's right.
And so that's a federal protection.
That's a federal protection, right. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the agency which worked on that and which is responsible for the designation. They have a good website page now. So if you Google rusty patch bumblebee, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you'll come up to their page. A lot of good resources there, maps and guidance about the bee. There's a lot of information about the bee. So that's a good way to get familiar with it right now, because it's all brought into one place.
Right. Mm-hmm. So practically speaking, what does that designation mean for the rusty patch bumblebee or organizations like the Arboretum who are working to conserve the bee?
Right. Well, for conservation, for areas where the bee is found mm-hmm. now, it's pretty important because we obviously have already been conserving it, but we need to make sure that there are. We would want like a community like Madison to have people aware so that practices are in place to make sure that harm isn't done to the bee. We're like one of the only. There's very few places that are still. Where the bee is still found, and it's not found in huge numbers. I don't see it in huge numbers, but that it's consistently present year after year.
Right.
That it is present even in our urban areas to some extent, and in our rural areas. So we need to make sure. And for homeowners, this habitat idea that we talked about before, these having flower resources available throughout the season, and this doesn't mean plants that bloom all season long, but paying careful attention to plants that provide pollen and nectar. So maybe there will be plants that provide it for a few weeks now, and then overlapping with plants that are blooming in May, overlapping with plants that are blooming in June, and so forth. And the native plants kind of provide this parade of blooming throughout the season, and that's great habitat. But sometimes people plant flowers that don't even attract pollinators.
Right. So that was a question that I had. Is it important, in your opinion, to plant native plants? Because I have heard that some non-native flowering plants aren't really all that attractive to native pollinators in North
well,
America.
Well, it's the answer's in the details.
Okay.
Because we have quite a number of horticultural ornamental plants in our garden, in our ornamental garden or horticultural garden at the Arboretum that's adjacent to the native plant garden that are excellent resources.
Okay.
Like right now, if the cherry trees are blooming, you go there and you do see like bumblebees visiting them. But I would say if you have a plant growing and you can observe it and nothing visits it, then maybe my opinion would be, maybe I can find something that insects will visit that I can plant in addition or replace, that plant with.
Right.
Depending on how, gardeners have all kinds of criteria for what they select. But I like to make a garden that kind of has a lot of wildlife value. And that's one way. Pollinator attracting is one really great wildlife value that you can add to your garden.
Right. You mentioned the cherry blossoms. What other flowering plants have you found to be really popular?
Well, in the early going right now, for pollinators in general, for bumblebees specifically, let's stick with that.
Sure.
Some of the woodland wildflowers, I'll think about the arboretum right now, the woodland wildflowers, some of the prairie plants that are blooming very early, like the shooting stars and wood betony is a small plant that's very attractive. The lupins, as we get into the season a little further. Also the flowering, some of the flowering apple, crab apples and trees like that would be important. Juneberry, very important. As we get later into the season, more into the early summer or so, the basswood tree is very important for bumblebees. So, one plant that I'll mention, and as a gardener, this one really shifted, my opinion toward it really shifted, but one thing that's just started to bloom in all of our areas is Creeping Charlie.
Oh, yeah.
And those mints, it's a mint, member of the mint family, and those mint flowers turn out to be a very important resource. And the queen bumblebees, it's a great place to, on Creeping Charlie, is a great place to see them because they'll be foraging. As I mentioned before, they need a lot of nectar. That's a nectar plant. And they're close to the ground, so you see them easily, and they're not way up in trees. So it's a good place to see them and photograph them early in the season.
Right.
So we usually let it bloom, and we're never rid of Creeping Charlie. We let it bloom and then pull out a few when it's when it's in its leaf stage.
Yeah. Now that you mention that, my mom is a pretty active gardener, and she kind of liked Creeping Charlie
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a lot of gardeners.
Yeah.
So she let it kind of go wild, and I do remember seeing a lot of bumblebees around the Creeping
mm-hmm.
Charlie on their patio.
Another important thing at home, besides the floral resource that you home gardeners should be aware of, is first of all, if you can eliminate insecticides from your garden, that's great,
mm-hmm.
And that. And we find with one reason to grow native plants is we don't really need to use any insecticides at all or fertilizer.
Gotcha.
And we practically don't have – and we really don't have to water them either. So there's a few inputs that you're saving yourself right there, time and expense, and you're being more sustainable. Also, the bumblebees need nesting sites. So they need some bare soil. That some of them nest underground, like a chipmunk hole or a ground squirrel net hole underground. They'll go into little cracks and crevices, maybe into a rock pile or a rock wall. So they need that kind of a space for their nesting. So if everything is all manicured and all raked up and there's no kind of areas like that, then they won't have a place to make a nest. And they have to have a nesting spot within range of flowering resource.
Yeah, how far is their range?
Well, they can go they could go several miles if they had to, but think about it. If the resource is close by, so let's say within a mile, then that colony doesn't have to expend as much energy and chance just to find the resource further away.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So I just have kind of one more question. You're a conservationist, so I think our listeners are probably definitely aware of the legacy and local connection to like other renowned, famous conservationists, Aldo Leopold, John Muir. What do you think, I don't know if you can speak to this at all, but what do you think someone like Aldo Leopold would have to say about the current state of conservation in Wisconsin and in the U.S., and what can we do, our listeners as citizens and activists, to promote conservation in a meaningful and productive way in 2017?
That's a big, big question.
Yeah,
didn't see that one coming. I know lots of people want to kind of translate on their own what Leopold would say now. He was obviously founder at the Arboretum, so we think about that. We live in the current time. I think that your listeners are probably, as for, around the issues of pollinators, this is a pretty essential issue.
Right.
And it's also very connected, not only with agriculture and agricultural practices that we can, you know, where agriculture in our state here can either do a disservice to pollinators or it can do a service to pollinators. And we have both things happening. So I think the listeners would want to be aware of what our practices both in your own yard and in the larger landscape that, that will keep the pollinator community strong and, by doing that, keep ecosystems healthier, land health and land, in the Leopold sense of soils, air, water, plants, animals,
right,
the whole picture. So, I think things that do promote land health are definitely in that mode. And, you know, just now we have different challenges. And so being aware of this, the effects of the insecticides and how can an individual work to create awareness with others. But I wrote an op-ed recently that was in Scientific American blogs, and one of my relatives read it.